Hey, this is Scott Galloway, author, professor, entrepreneur, and most importantly, host of the Prop G podcast. We got a special series running on right now called The Future of Work, where I answer all your questions on, surprise, the future of work. Questions including, what are we missing when we work remotely? Or how do we handle work-life balance when a major opportunity comes knocking? From the provocative to the technical, we're offering insights you won't want to miss. So tune in to The Future of Work, a Prop G Pod special sponsored by Canva. You can find it on the Prop G Pod wherever you get your podcasts.
Support for this show comes from Sylvan Learning. When children love learning, they can tackle any challenge life throws at them. Sylvan's Insight Assessment can help you determine if your child is ready for what's ahead. It can also identify gaps in learning and point out areas that could be of concern for your child so they can tackle what's to come. And right now, it's the best price of the year at $29. Go to sylvan29.com to learn more and get your child's assessment for only $29. That's SYLVAN29.com.
In times of crisis, leaders often accrue unprecedented amounts of power, and then sometimes they don't give it back. There's a concern right now that this is happening globally during the coronavirus pandemic, with Hungary, which may now be Europe's first modern authoritarian state, leading the way. I'm Zach Beecham, here as always with Jen Williams and Alex Ward on Worldly, part of the Vox Media Podcast Network. Hi, Worldly team.
Hey.
What's going on?
I'm under a blanket.
Good.
Jen is under a blanket. It's super funny looking. It's like a floral printy thing. Maybe there's a few leaves in there. And it keeps like riding over Jen's face. So sometimes we just see a mouth and some disembodied tattoos talking to us. It's like, it's a very strange way of interacting with somebody. So yeah, as you listeners are aware of at this point, we are recording from our home studios, which is to say just places in our actual houses. We apologize for any errors in the quality of sound. So we are talking about a common feature of crises of any sort, which is that leaders who have authoritarian tendencies often tend to use them to expand their own power. And this is true both in authoritarian states where it's to be expected, but also in countries that are nominally democratic, but have elected leaders who have consolidated their own power and used it to undermine the process of elections themselves. No country is more known for this phenomenon than Hungary, where just in this past week, the parliament, which is controlled by Prime Minister Viktor Orban's government, passed a bill that would essentially give him the ability to rule by dictate for as long as he wants, not just the duration of the crisis, but literally as long as he sees fit to be in charge of the country and ruling it by his own orders. Jen, Alex, is there any other order like it that you're aware of in any democracy around the world?
Democracy, no. I mean, we see these kinds of orders all the time in authoritarian kind of countries. The sweeping power here in Hungary is so pervasive. I mean, we'll go into the details momentarily, but I think just generally speaking, it's important to note that it has effectively cut off any form of dissent, especially from journalists. It has given the authorities a lot of power to kind of jail people for staying outside of quarantines or whatever it may be. And it has suspended a lot of the political processes, whether it be elections, whether it be actually having a parliament, et cetera. And so like this is unheard of in the democratic world. I mean, democratic nations do take a lot of steps that trample on civil freedoms and whatnot, and we'll get into those. But this is way beyond. This is very much centralizing the power in the executive and in Orban specifically in Hungary. And so this is why it's stepped outside of kind of the norm and broken through outside of all the other cases that we'll soon talk about. This is so much further and so much more authoritarian than we've seen. And it's even leading calls. I mean, it's gotten so bad that even some in the European Union are saying maybe it's time to kick Hungary out.
Yeah, Zach, longtime Worldly listeners probably know that you did a really awesome reporting trip in Hungary in the not too distant past. Time has no meaning to me anymore. We are in the 93rd day of March, I think.
That's correct, yes. Even though it's April 1st when we're recording this, yeah.
And since you know a lot about Hungary and have done some really great on-the-ground reporting there, I wonder if you could just walk us through in detail what specifically Orbán did, what these orders are, and how he pushed it through. Because I'm still, you know, I know the kind of general outline, but I wonder if you could just walk us through the details here.
Yeah, so it's important to understand the background here. That is to say, what the Orbán government has been doing for the past 10 years, roughly, that it's been in power. Orbán was prime minister of the country. This is not his first time in power. He was shortly after the end of the Cold War, and his party lost an election, an early one. And he decided afterwards that the problem was not with anything that he had done, but with the voters and the media. And so when his his Fidesz faction, or Fidesz, depending on how accurate you want to be in terms of the Hungarian pronunciation, I'm not going to be accurate this time because my Hungarian is very, very bad. Orbán, after taking power this time around, systematically worked to undermine the free functioning of democracy. Now, this has not been, until right now, a overtly authoritarian takeover of the state. That's a relatively new thing. What he has done instead is very, very subtly corrupt the system to rig the playing field of elections, specifically parliamentary elections, the important ones, and to make it difficult for anyone to fund or start up any meaningful opposition bloc. So this involves things like redistributing economic and regulatory favors towards his friends and his political allies, buying up media broadcasters and newspapers to the point where something like 90% of all media outlets in Hungary, by one estimate, are owned either by the government or by its associates, that is to say business leaders or rich people who have been empowered by the state to work with them, and to make it so that elections are functionally non-competitive. And by functionally non-competitive, I don't mean that the opposition can't run and they can't say what they want to say. They can do all of those things. Until recently, you didn't go to jail in Hungary for expressing dissent. What they did was make it such that it was already difficult to begin with because they gerrymandered the map pretty profoundly so that Fidesz would have structural advantages in the electorate. They also would not give equal time to opposition members. They would do tricks like stand up fake parties with similar names. This one is less proven, but still plausible, to the point where votes would be split.
Wow, seriously?
Yeah. They tried this before.
That's crazy. Mm.
That's something I heard on the ground from people in Hungary. But the point was to make it so that it still looked like a democratic political system. It talked like a democratic political system. But, you know, when you're actually paying attention, close and very, very detailed attention to the way the electoral system functioned, you would realize that this is not an electoral system at all. It's a way of legitimizing one-man rule. They've also amended the constitution in a variety of different ways with a two-thirds majority, which they've won repeatedly in these rigged elections. So when I was there in 2018, there was still a live debate as to whether Hungary was an authoritarian or democratic state. And I made the case in my piece, which I'll link to in the notes, that it was not a democratic state, that it was essentially making a mockery of the idea of democracy. And there are still some people in the West, even, who have defended this as merely an expression of the populist right-wing will in Hungarian society. When in fact, Orbán, he has real popular support, I don't want to understate this, but in fact, Orbán, you know, in the last election, he won under 50% of the vote, but over two-thirds of the seats in parliament. And that's even despite systematic rigging with the media. This isn't a guy who's winning on a wave of popular support, even though he does have some in reality. The current order, you know, part of me wonders why they decided to issue this at all, because it strips away the subtle and clever veneer that the Orbán government had used to claim that they were still a democratic state. As Alex said, it indefinitely suspends democratic procedure, most notably by giving Orbán the ability to issue authoritative dictates. So he just sort of says something.
So a literal
and it does.
Dictator. Yeah,
yes, exactly, right? What's more is that this order doesn't have an expiration date. It doesn't say until X amount of COVID cases are under control. It just, as long as Orbán himself decides that he wants to rule this way, he can. Now, it's possible for Parliament to vote and remove the powers from him, and maybe they will, but if they do, it won't be in a way that provides meaningful constraints on Orbán's power because, again, it is controlled two-thirds by Fidesz. The court also has oversight, but Orban has systematically worked to pack the courts with his cronies and neuter the court's jurisdiction to make it difficult for them to overturn the ruling. And if you want to report critically on this, if you're in the 10% of media outlets that are not owned by the government or one of its allies, you can be put in jail for 5 years under this legislation for spreading false information. Now, this is supposed to be, in theory, about coronavirus. Of course, when you have one strong man in charge, a guy who's again and again demonstrated his authoritarian instincts, there's no doubt that what this means is he wants to seize power and he wants to jail people who threaten him.
Just to play devil's advocate here, and you know, I don't actually, you know, agree with this, but there is the coronavirus crisis in Europe, right? There's one here in the United States. There's, you know, a pandemic going on. First of all, I kind of want to know, like, what is the coronavirus situation in Hungary? Like, are they in the same kind of situation that, like, in Italy or Spain or even parts of the U.S., like in New York? Two, you know, I know part of this bill basically is allowing, like you said, him to, you know, Orban to basically issue dictates from the top down. But it would seem to maybe make some sense, as we're seeing potentially in the U.S., of, you know, needing a strong federal government to handle things, you know, at a federal level, rather than allowing, you know, local and state, you know, or regional leaders making kind of ad hoc patchwork decisions. So one, what's the situation look like? And two, is there any possibility that this is actually like a good move, even if it doesn't end, and that itself is pretty scary?
Yeah, I mean, I think those are fair questions and they're both wrong. So, you know, yeah,
so
I mean,
guys.
The last amount of cases I've seen, and I'm sure the situation changes all the time, but right. Last estimate I saw was about 400 or so positive cases in Hungary. That's okay. Incredibly small, yeah, compared to what we've seen in Italy, what we've seen in Spain, what we've seen in the United States, what we've seen in South Korea and elsewhere. The notion that Hungary is facing such a crisis that it requires a dictator literally from the top to solve the crisis is moot. It's never good to have 400 something people sick this way, but it is not necessarily worse. It's not even close to one of the worst cases in the world. Plus, we've also seen democracies handle these crises without needing dictates. South Korea is a good example. Heck, I know the United States situation's out of control, but we've ramped up testing and a whole bunch of other measures without needing a dictatorial rule. So I guess what's been proven is you do not need authoritarianism, or as Zach also wrote eloquently before, and we'll link to the show notes, like this notion of authoritarian envy, like if only we had these strongman rulers in charge, we would somehow be able to curb the scourge early enough. And like to maybe try to answer one of Zach's questions is, you know, why is Hungary doing this now?
Yeah.
Why so blatantly? And I can't say to have any special knowledge here, but if I were a betting man, I would say that Hungary is in the EU, and so it had to abide by even a thin veneer of democratic practice. At a time when everyone is focused on only one thing, and especially when a lot of EU countries are facing a lot of this problem, France, Spain, Italy, their attention is turned elsewhere, and now that thin veneer doesn't need to be there anymore. And what's helpful, I guess, for someone like Orban is when you make these kinds of laws, when you make these kinds of moves, they tend to stick. It's really hard to remove them. And so, yeah, we're all criticizing, and there'll be podcast episodes about Orban is doing a bad thing, but this too shall pass, and these laws will remain. And that's what I worry, is that he's taken advantage of the small window to probably do something he's wanted to do, but had some constraint against. And now that constraint is gone, he's gone full throttle.
Yeah, it strikes me, Alex, to that point, as a serious case of authoritarian overreach in some ways, like a counterproductive move on the Orban government's part. So for one thing, as you've pointed out, and I wrote in this other piece, it is simply incorrect that authoritarian powers are necessary to combat the coronavirus. In fact, if you look across cases, I spoke to a number of different experts about this, there's no evidence that authoritarian states are performing better. And some of the worst countries, for example, Iran and early on China, failed due to the nature of their authoritarian systems. And that's part of why we have a global outbreak to begin with. By contrast, some democracies like South Korea, Taiwan, have performed relatively well, right? It's just there's no systematic comparison or argument for why you need authoritarian rule by one person or one political party powers in order to do the measures necessary to contain coronavirus, which are compatible with, you know, still standard democratic functioning. The second point is, I think Orban, and this is a little bit of speculation, but it's based in part on talking to people who know him personally, used to work with him, including one legislator who was in his party until she realized who he was and quit, is that he is a guy who really wants and likes to have power, right? He wants to rule as a one person state. That is what he has been building towards. It was frustrating for him to have to put up with even the veneer of a democratic system, even though it was cleverly designed to keep him not afoul of EU rules about democracy. You're supposed to still be a democracy if you're going to be in the European Union. And it is a big deal for Hungary to be in the EU. Reason being, the EU gives them a tremendous amount of subsidies, which the government has used to funnel money to their preferred businesses and private sector leaders, and also just generally keep their economy afloat despite poor management by the Orban regime. So it strikes me as overreach, not just because it's unnecessary for dealing with the coronavirus problem, but because it is in fact likely to produce a backlash. You already have people in the European Union talking about what kinds of punishments, or not exactly sanctions in the sense of like what America does to countries it doesn't like, but other kinds of internal rules that might maybe restrict the flow of money to Hungary, have hearings of some sort about its continued membership in the EU. Right? If it gets cut off from EU funding and resources, there isn't an obvious way for the government to make up the gap. Moreover, it strikes me, this is from talking to Hungarians again, that it's really, really important for the regime's legitimacy to be able to tell its people that they still live in a democracy. If you look at polling inside Hungary, people still believe that they should have a democracy. I think ordinary citizens believed, at least as of 2018, that they were still living in one. That was part of the point of having a state-bought media, right? You can convince people they're living in a democracy, even though they're not. But if they do this, and then they now recently there's a new push to try to take power away from mayors at the local level. It just so happens that some of the mayors in the country's largest cities, including Budapest, are opposition party mayors, that they actually managed to, despite the playing field being so tilted against them, managed to win some local elections, which is an extraordinary feat and a testament to the fact that maybe Hungarians are starting to get tired of the way that Orban had been running the country. Now, it's going to be much, 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 much more difficult to say, we respect the will of the people, we respect what they decided to do, and that could, in theory, there have been street protests against government policies that have successfully forced them to back off, that could engender a serious popular backlash against the regime.
So that's kind of why I actually think that the timing right now is really smart on Orban's part. Not that I support this idea, but I think the timing actually makes a lot of sense because, one, just talking about popular protests and backlash, well, if everyone's scared of getting coronavirus and, you know, doesn't want to gather in large groups, that makes protesting a lot harder, just physically, you know, logistically. So there's that. There's also the kind of broader, you know, idea, a lot of strongmen dictators, we've seen this in authoritarian regimes across the world and over time, they like to present themselves often as this benevolent father figure who is watching over the country and protecting you and keeping you safe. And I can understand at a time of great fear over coronavirus, Alex, like you said, they may only have a comparatively low number of cases, but their neighbors and other countries in the EU have a lot more cases. And I can understand that presenting himself as this, look, I'm just doing this to protect you. It reminds me a lot of, you know, how you see Putin trying to set himself up as like this wise elder leading Russia. You've seen that obviously in the Kim family regimes throughout time in North Korea as like, we are the ones protecting you from this threat. So I think in that sense, it makes sense that the question, which I think you've both gotten at, is, okay, that lasts for only so long, right? Once this threat goes away, and it will, it may be months or you know, a year, but it will. And at that point, if he doesn't then rescind it, which it, you know, everything points to the fact that he probably won't, then do you start to see popular protests? Then do you start to see the backlash? I think for now, capitalizing on fear, a lot of people just want to make sure that their government's in control and doing something in a way that people who don't normally like government control, you know, might not otherwise have those kind of stronger feelings. Like, I want to feel like somebody's in charge and taking control and keeping me safe. So I will let him have these powers for now. The question again is, what happens when the crisis is over.
We're going to take a quick break because Jen helpfully brought up the fact that this is not just a Hungary problem, but actually a global problem. We're going to talk about a few other places where the coronavirus crisis has served as an opportunity for authoritarian leaders to, or authoritarian-minded leaders in democracies, to try to expand their own powers or scope of control of the state.
Hey, this is Scott Galloway, author, professor, entrepreneur, and most importantly, host of the Prop G podcast. We got a special series running on right now called The Future of Work, where I answer all your questions on, surprise, the future of work. Questions including, what are we missing when we work remotely? Or how do we handle work-life balance when a major opportunity comes knocking? From the provocative to the technical, we're offering insights you won't want to miss. So tune in to The Future of Work, a Prop G Pod special sponsored by Canva. You can find it on the Prop G Pod wherever you get your podcasts.
Support for this show comes from Sylvan Learning. As a parent, you want your child to have every opportunity. But giving them the tools they need to tackle every challenge, that takes a team. Now more than ever, educational support tailored exactly to what your child needs can make all the difference. That's why parents have trusted Sylvan Learning for 45 years as the ultimate teammate in their child's educational journey, instilling in them a love for learning and a passion for reaching the next level. And Sylvan's Insight Assessment can identify gaps in learning and areas that could be of concern for your child. It's a 360-degree view into your child's learning that you can't find anywhere else, and helps ensure that your child didn't miss something in school that might put them at a disadvantage in the future. And right now, it's the best price of the year at $29. Go to sylvan29.com to learn more and get your child's assessment for only $29. That's sylvan29.com.
Welcome back, worldly listeners. We are talking about what is effectively a constitutional coup in Hungary, where the parliament handed the prime minister dictatorial powers in keeping with his long-held authoritarian ambitions. Hungary is the most extreme case of the coronavirus being used as a pretext for a power grab, but it is not the only one, right? There are several countries around the world where authoritarian leaders or authoritarian-minded leaders have taken on new powers, disturbing powers, and tried new legislative or political tactics that they might not otherwise have been willing to do because the crisis has legitimized some sorts of power grabs. Now, to your mind, you two, what do you think some of the more egregious examples are outside of Hungary?
Two stand out to me in particular, both in South America. So one is in Bolivia, which we've talked about on the show before. The quick recap here is that there was a rigged election, at least that's what most election observers say, and the president Morales, Evo Morales, left, and then the caretaker from the opposite, more right-leaning party, actually a lot more right-leaning party, has come in. And because of the coronavirus, that caretaker is now postponing elections and possibly trying to keep power in her office. For some, there was worry of, oh, was this a coup against Morales? And again, I think the statistics of the election show that that's not the case. But now it looks like this is someone who's trying to stay in power and using the coronavirus as an excuse. And so without elections, without any actual kind of democratic process, going strictly from the caretaker role to just being in charge. And then nearby in Chile, there's been a long-going tension between its military and its people. There were protesters against government's actions, and the government decided to send the military out to those areas to push the protesters out, to end the demonstrations. If there was a case of large-scale violence, one could see somewhat of a case for doing that. This was not the case. These were protesters. There was some incidents of, or some reports of perhaps some small bouts of violence, but largely peaceful in the grand scheme of things based on most reports. And yet the military was still called in to quash the dissent. And so in just these two cases, we're seeing again the excuse of, oh, there is a coronavirus crisis being used by governments to either hold on to power that has been usurped in many senses, and then also to quell dissent against government. Both of these incidents, they sound less serious in the Hungary case than they are in the grand scheme of things, right? These are not, but still, this is what happens when you have a not just a national crisis, but international crisis, and it gives leaders that are not so tied to democratic principles, small d, the opening to do things like this.
Yeah. You know, the one country that I've been keeping my eye on a lot, and it's one that we talk a lot about in the same context as we often talk about Hungary and other, you know, countries that we're watching that were once quasi-democratic or moving toward democracy and are now, you know, backsliding towards authoritarianism, and it's Turkey. You know, in recent years, we've seen President Erdogan of Turkey really try to clamp down on dissent, trying to exert more control over the media and control narratives. He is post-coup, the attempted coup against his rule. He has locked up journalists. He's locked up, you know, people of all walks of life. And, you know, we're seeing him kind of extending that control and using the coronavirus again as the pretext or as the reason for doing that. So what they're doing is they're really trying to crack down on what they're saying is misinformation about the coronavirus. And, you know, again, on at surface level, right? That sounds like a good thing, right? You don't want people spreading misinformation and getting people killed, you know, and saying that certain things are cures if they're not, or saying that the virus is not dangerous when it is. That's kind of the argument that they're making, right? That we're just trying to crack down on misinformation. The reality is that they're cracking down on people who are going against the status quo narrative of what Erdogan says is happening in the country. So while it may be some cases of misinformation, you have the government, you have Erdogan deciding what is misinformation. And there's this really remarkable moment. This truck driver who had this viral video talking about the virus, he was arrested and he was finally released because the public was really mad. But Turkey's interior ministry was talking about the guy's detention and, you know, why he was detained. And he said that nearly 3,000 social media accounts had been identified for propagating misinformation. And then he said, we're trying to detain as many as possible. Like, not even sugarcoating it, right? Like, literally, like, no, we're trying to arrest literally everyone on these social media accounts. And that's really scary, right? And it's the same kind of thing, because if it's misinformation, again, about something that's dangerous, that's one thing. But if you're posting on social media criticizing the government and saying maybe Erdogan's not doing enough, or I'm not getting supplies I need at my hospital, and they come and arrest you, like, that's the same thing we saw in China, right? That's the same thing that caused arguably this outbreak in the first place. So not only is that scary for democracy, it's also just scary for the coronavirus response.
And sorry, just quickly to add, like, this is the kind of thing we're seeing elsewhere. Even in Thailand, the prime minister is now like going after journalists who criticize the government, or right, pretty much anyone who criticizes the government, like, all under, oh, we have to make sure we have the right information for coronavirus. This seems to be one of the common plays. It's fascinating to see this happen in Europe, Asia, Latin America, kind of all Middle East, across the board. This seems to be one of the major plays.
Well, I mean, it makes perfect sense, right? As Jen said, everyone agrees that you need to be dealing with coronavirus misinformation because it can literally get people killed. It is in the structure of a public health crisis that it is really, really important that individuals take specific action on their own in ways that the state just can't force them to, which means the information, like, you can't have a government agent in your house making you wash your hands. Right. So under those circumstances, it's really important that people get the right messages, that viral misinformation, no pun intended, be corrected on social media. Like, that sort of thing is vital. Yet in a country where the leadership is not democratically accountable, or is dubiously democratically accountable, or hell, even is democratically accountable, but can figure out some way to temporarily get around it, right? It's much easier to abuse the same steps to insulate yourself from any kind of legitimate and meaningful criticism, right? That's why this transcends region and really speaks to the nature of the people in power in all of these various different governments we've been talking about. It's that they have a degree of authority. They care more about maintaining it than they do about ensuring the continued viability of democratic practice in their country. And so they're willing to exploit the coronavirus using plausible sounding excuses. It is really the perfect situation for somebody who wants to clamp down on the free flow of information. And so you're seeing that happen in country after country in different ways.
I don't know if we made this clear in the Hungary situation, but I believe, and tell me, Zach, if I have this wrong, but part of the measures, the state of emergency measures that Orban put in place mean that there are no rallies and no elections that can be held during the state of emergency. Is that correct?
Yeah, okay. No, that's right. That's right.
That, to me, you know, even more than the suppression of dissent and, you know, control of information, that is potentially even more terrifying because you talked about democratic accountability, right? That actually takes away that democratic accountability very directly. I'm not in any way trying to suggest that the situation in the U.S. is comparable or that Trump is comparable to Orban at all, just to make that clear. But we are seeing concerns among people, especially, you know, on the left, obviously. You know, what happens? Are we going to have an election, you know, here in the U.S.? Because this is an election year. And there are a lot of people who are scared that, like, could Trump suspend the elections? And, you know, there's a lot of discussion that looks like, you know, legally he probably couldn't and we would still get it done. But there was a moment this week when Trump was, I think, overheard saying, I'm not sure the exact context, but was basically talking about, you know, the issue of whether we could do mail-in ballots for all these elections that are coming up. And he was essentially saying, we shouldn't do that. We can't do that because then Republicans will never win another election. And I'm paraphrasing. But that response is really scary because it's like a very overt political response, like, no, we can't do that. And so again, I think, you know, the concerns over the coronavirus make even holding elections, you know, sketchy and scary and unclear whether you can do them in a fair way. And so it's just another way to kind of erode that democratic accountability that's really scary.
We've been talking mostly about dubiously democratic or questionably democratic states, right? But this is, as Jen points out, potentially a problem even for countries that have long democratic traditions. You know, in Israel, for instance, the parliament speaker, who is a member of Prime Minister Netanyahu's party, refused to comply with a court order that would force the government to seat the parliament where the opposition held a majority. And this maneuver, which had thrown the country's political system into chaos, basically coerced the leader of the opposition, for reasons that are totally unclear to me, into joining up with the government for what he claims are the duration of the crisis, but seems to empower Netanyahu, who's been acting throughout this crisis, swiftly and sometimes in ways that are consistent with public health dictates, but also in ways that fit with his longstanding authoritarian tendencies, to try to hold on to power at any cost. And now the opposition is fractured and Netanyahu has a relatively solid majority in parliament. You know, in Britain, you've seen pretty substantially stepped up surveillance powers that the Johnson government has received, and real concerns from civil libertarians that they just won't give those up after the coronavirus crisis is over. So while it obviously is a bigger problem in states where the leadership actively is dedicated to dismantling democracy, even in countries that are more solidly democratic, and Israel's increasingly not in that situation for reasons that we've talked about on other shows, it creates a problem for the tenuous balance of rights and freedoms that you need for a democracy to be functioning in the way that you want it to, for people to feel free enough to act in how they like in their private life, as well as to participate politically and to challenge the government in public life. And there's like a spectrum here, right? It's not just democracy, not democracy. It's, can emergency powers accrued during times like these end up eroding the quality of democracy in your country? And we saw that pretty vividly in the United States after 9/11 with the expansion of police powers and the Patriot Act and stuff like that. But now increasingly you're seeing it to varying degrees in pure democracies and struggling democracies alike.
Yeah, I don't want to let that America point go because I think that's incredibly illustrative and important. I mean, let's remember, I mean, yes, we all remember 9/11. We don't have to go through that. But what happened next, which at the time you could make some reasonable arguments for, was a large surveillance capability to survey, you know, foreigners and some Americans who were in contact with foreigners. It's all their communications, these warrants to spy on people effectively to see what they were up to because they might be suspected of doing terrorist acts or whatever it may be. I mean, it goes on and on. And all of this was done with the, well, we just don't want another 9/11 to happen again and the government needs to have control. There's actually like kind of decent-ish arguments for those authorities, that are at least more plausible arguments that you can make. But what happened was, and this goes to a warning I kind of mentioned earlier, is like a lot of those powers remain, or a lot of those powers stayed or are around in some form. And once you put these in place, they don't go away anytime soon. And so while the intention of like, oh, well, we need these surveillance capabilities to stop another 9/11 may have been put in with the correct views, it eventually morphed. And other people were like, well, this also has applicability elsewhere. Or if we got rid of these authorities, then we would lose an important capability to continue to fight terrorism or other national security issues. And like, this is the problem, is that when in moments of crisis and emergency, what you'd want is the government to maybe take these steps, but with a very clear timeline or very clear sort of illustration of here's how we're using it and here's when it's going to go away. And we're not really seeing that in any of these cases, right? What we're seeing are governments say, we want to do X, Y, Z because we are protecting people right now and protecting them for future pandemics. And what they're really doing is using the crisis of the moment to grab power. Luckily, quote unquote, in the U.S., it seems like a lot of those post 9/11 authorities are starting to wane. Some do remain, and again, in different forms. But like that fight still continues. And it's gotten to the point, actually, and this is to add, like there was an article recently, Glenn Greenwald, of all people, who has fought against the surveillance state, has kind of come out and effectively been like, well, we might need stuff like that to deal with coronavirus. And so like, this is the kind of thing that happens, right? When a moment like this pops up, we have these kinds of initiatives where governments try to take more control, and some people are okay with it and kind of let it happen.
One thing that I will say that has been remarkable, and to Trump's credit, you know, I may come to eat my words, and who knows what will happen, but to Trump's credit so far, I mean, he was asked in one of the recent press conferences that he holds every single day on the coronavirus, he was asked, you know, are you considering or would you consider imposing these kinds of surveillance measures like we've seen in Israel and other countries, where they're basically using like cell phone data and other surveillance tools to track people to make sure like you're staying at home, or, you know, you're not gathering in groups, where you're going, things like that, to try to track and control the coronavirus. And he said no. He was pretty clear, and he even kind of made fun of it and said, like, what's going to happen? What, there's going to be like a siren goes off on your phone? Oh no, you're standing too close to this person. Woo, woo. Which is interesting. I don't think I ever would have expected to be in a situation or a world in which Glenn Greenwald is arguing for more use of the surveillance state and Donald Trump is saying, that seems a little extreme, guys, but that's where we are right now. And so I will say, you know, in that sense, to Trump's credit, we're not there yet, and hopefully we won't be.
I don't want to let the U.S. off the hook completely, because there were reports that the Department of Justice was thinking about issuing an order where they would basically be able to arrest people if they were suspected of kind of not following the rules or something along those lines. It was basically reducing restrictions on the ability to arrest. And very swiftly, there was a lot of political opposition to it from the right and the left. And so they moderated that stance. But I'm not saying that the U.S. response here has not been very clean. There were these kinds of thoughts have popped up. They just haven't been enacted.
Sure.
This is not a time where everything is safe. In fact, it's a time where bad political actors are going to exploit the situation for their own advantage, and oftentimes to the detriment of the public and popular sovereignty. I want to thank our producer, Bird Pinkerton. I want to encourage all of you to rate, subscribe, and review Worldly wherever you get your podcasts. And we will see you all next week.
Hey, this is Scott Galloway, author, professor, entrepreneur, and most importantly, host of the Prop G podcast. We got a special series running on right now called The Future of Work, where I answer all your questions on, surprise, the future of work. Questions including, what are we missing when we work remotely? Or how do we handle work-life balance when a major opportunity comes knocking? From the provocative to the technical, we're offering insights you won't want to miss. So tune in to The Future of Work, a Prop G Pod special sponsored by Canva. You can find it on the Prop G Pod wherever you get your podcasts.